Hey, it's Jen Hatmaker. Here's what I've learned in midlife. Joy isn't the reward you earn after all the work is done. Joy is the work. That's what this new series on For the Love is all about. The sacred, yes. It's choosing delight, rest, and pleasure on purpose. Because saying yes to yourself, that's the thing that finally lets you fill your table with everybody else. Come find your sacred yes with me. Follow and listen to For the Love wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with co-authors Robert Polito and John Melendez on the 2026 book Whistle Stop, The Life of Kenny Dorham. We take a deep dive into the first biography of this jazz legend and his journey from Texas to the cutting edge of bebop. Dr. Polito is a professor of political science, and he teams up with his son, John Melendez, to write a biography that blends close listening with careful history to place the legendary trumpeter squarely within the American narrative. His father and son joint effort draws on both writers' strengths. It highlights a journey from rural Texas to the forefront of modern jazz as it mirrors the broader story of Black resilience and creativity in 20th century America. It's a wonderful story. Enjoy this interview.
I really, really dig Whistle Stop. Hopefully you can see. I got a cop. Yeah, here's my copy.
Yeah, yeah.
And the thing that I find fascinating about these biographies, especially with someone like Kenny, and you made it very clear, there are so many unsung heroes in the world of jazz. There are so many people like I, as much as I like Charlie Parker and I'm from Kansas City and it's the golden child that came from here. It's like, we got to move on to some other people. You know, it's like when Hollywood just regurgitates movies, like we didn't need another Footloose after the Kevin Bacon one. I'm sorry. We just didn't. Right. Cape Fear was kind of okay, but they've redone it. It's like we have to get to a point where we put new stories and new material in the world. And Kenny is perfect for that. So with that being said, I want to know the big bang, the actual alpha of the beginning of this process. What made you pick Kenny? What made you go gung-ho and do this enormous body of work and interview to make this book?
I think you would have to say, because I feel like it was your...
Yeah, so yeah. I think you know we're father and son, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So when I was in college, which is a long time ago, you know, I played trumpet as a kid, but I wanted to learn how to play jazz trumpet, and my dad had some records, and there was just something about, I think it was Max Roach Plus Four record, when I heard Kenny Dorham for the first time, I was just completely fascinated, because, you know, of all the other Clifford Brown and Donald Byrd and other people I was listening to, he just had something different in the way he could express, you know, himself in a solo, using, you know, the passing tones and the way that he did and the substitutions. So I had this idea for years and years. And then when John came along, and then when John started to play, I guess you were about 11 when you started to play jazz, right?
I think
so. Piano. And so we started talking about doing this together, because John has a lot more formal training in music than I do. And so, you know, he knows theory in a much deeper way than I do. And so maybe about 6 years ago, we started talking about, what if we actually did this book together, because we both have things. You know, and he's, you know, he's a really good writer, and he writes differently from me, and he writes about different things. So we thought it would be really interesting to try to shine a light on Kenny Dorham, but to bring the different things that we both have to it. That's what I would say is the genesis.
Yeah, yeah. In like 2020, we talked about, and it was kind of, I think, good timing, because his last book had just come out, and I had just finished my music performance degree. And so we were like, oh, we could do this book together, and we could talk about different you know, elements of the music and the history, and he could bring sort of more the historical perspective and the sociopolitical perspective, and I could maybe talk a little bit more about some of the nuts and bolts music.
Yeah,
yeah. Although, sure. I mean, part of what you'll notice is there is definitely some overlap between
for sure
some of our interests and some of the different chapters we wrote little bits of.
Yeah. And the other crazy thing is, so when I started to buy albums, back when we would buy albums and CDs, you know, I saw these references to an autobiography that he had written, that Kenny Dorham had written. And it was so beautiful, and it was so fascinating. I thought, I have to track down this document. And when we finally did, it's only 5 pages long. So it's this incredible essay. And I'm sure you know, it's quoted a lot, but that's all there is. And apparently Dan Morgenstern said that Kenny Dorham wanted to write a full autobiography, and obviously ran out of time to do it. So that became almost like, a jumping off point. He would mention something in there and then went to Texas and saw some of these places, and you could really see what he was talking about.
You know, it's interesting you talk about this. There's a, you know, because when we think about jazz trumpet from that era of bebop, we think about Miles, and there's always these seminal figures, but all of them came from different regions of the world and they had their own blend. Like, you know, Miles came from East St. Louis, came from affluent, wealthy parents, and there was definitely a sound that I think probably really developed once he got around the New York scene and really kind of got into that cauldron. But, you know, with Kansas City, there's always that blues tinge that goes into it. And I think about it like barbecue. Like, you know, Kansas City barbecue is way different from Texas barbecue. And I think about Kenny, what he brought in. Like, there was this Texas style to it. Like, Texas has this sweet, minced with salt, but Kansas City's all salt. So there was a level of Kenny, right?
That's great.
Metaphorically speaking, that came in with this sweeter tone where when you hear it, you're like, that's different from what I'm used to from that era. And I
Yeah, I
think
love that.
that's the thing that's so wonderful about Kenny is that he, anytime you listen to him, like even Clifford and any of these other early cats, is they had this blend that came from their roots, from where they're from. So in writing this book, did you notice that there was this real adherence to that Texas kind of notion of where he came from?
Definitely. I mean, I think that's a big part of where the title came from. Because we not only do we love that album, but we felt like it really exemplified that blues element of his playing. And so often, I mean, I actually had to stop myself from writing this too many times, but so often, you know, he pulls off some crazy, snaking, long, you know, bebop line, and he just like stings like a blues lick or like one or two notes or something. And it's just this thing that I think a lot of older musicians talk about a lot as being, as you know, kind of this lost art form where it's like it's this, you know, kind of beautiful element of the phrasing that he has, and it just feels so natural and so satisfying to hear. So definitely I think the barbecue metaphor is right in there for
Yeah,
sure.
I like that a lot.
Yeah, we actually have a one of the general manager for the Blue Room off 18 and Vine, his name is Gerald Dunn. He just opened a barbecue place out here in the suburbs that I work in, Grandview, and he's from Texas. So he's minced both worlds together. And it's like, that's not Kansas City, but it's good. It's like, I love it, but it's just different. And I think, too, the thing with Kenny and with trumpet players and horn players is it's not just how they hit it on their own, it's how they intermesh with the groups they're in. Like,
Sure.
what are they doing? How are they complimenting? How's the conversation going? And again, Kenny had a very distinct way of standing out on albums with the way that he would interplay. So my question to you is, like, what were some of your favorite songs of his, favorite configurations of play that he was involved in?
You know, I think for me, the album that I go back to the most and is probably Una Mas. I think it's really special to hear him. I mean, for me, it's really special to hear him with Herbie Hancock as a pianist, and just the, I think some of those 60s albums don't get enough credit. And then I also feel like that is an ensemble. It's so interesting to hear kind of his interactions with. It's a little looser. It's a little more abstract, and so grooving, especially on some of those Latin numbers. And then I just love hearing the way I mean, he played with Tony Williams also on Andrew Hill's Point of Departure, which I also really love. But hearing him interact with the way Tony Williams approached, you know, his blend of swing, getting to hear him kind of lock in with that is just so special to me. So that would be my answer.
Yeah, I'm thinking about what you said that when he's with different people, he sounds a little bit different and he blends with them. And I think the records he did with Sonny Rollins, you know, that their sounds kind of blend a little bit. And then with Hank Mobley as well, I can't exactly put it into words how he would change, but it just sounds. You know, when he's on the front line with one person, you know, it sounds different from another person. Like he's listening to what they're doing. And sometimes it's just as simple as being able to continue a thought. Like when the saxophonist finishes a solo on an idea, he'll pick up the same idea. And lots of people do that, but he just did it so well.
The one thing about doing so much research on one person is that you're inevitably going to run into things that you had no idea about. I mean, and obviously you're doing that because you're orchestrating this narrative that no one really knows about. But for you as the practitioner or the authors, you're going to run into some things. What were the things that you discovered about Kenny and that era and how he interacted with it that was totally surprising to you, kind of out of left field?
I mean, this wasn't, I wouldn't say this was, this didn't come as a huge shock, but I think something that I found really affecting kind of in the late stage of the book was just reading about some of the later bands that he had, and just the way he mentored people. I mean, we definitely went into the book thinking, that he's had a reputation as being a nice guy, but the way that he mentored people and the way that he wasn't, he definitely held people to a high technical standard in his band, but the way that he really went to bat for different people or hire people or give them advice or just try to help them out in these different ways, really, I thought was nice. And for people who, obviously there's those famous pairings that he had with different people, but even just musicians who maybe are not household names. So yeah, just getting the kind of generosity confirmed, I think. Maybe it was, again, not a shock because we thought he was nice, but to know that it was real and substantive and that people really miss. I mean, a lot of people really echoed this thing of like people who are still around and just really missing him.
Yeah, and the way he did it, so he would say, "Come over to my house," and then they would bring like a piece of music or something, and he'd work on it with them. That was so vivid, what the vivid demonstration of what John's talking about, like that's how he would, one of the ways that he would do that.
I think, well, and then I guess the sort of more technical thing I might say is we had a great interview with trumpet player, and he was talking about the connection between something that comes up later in the book, but the connection between Kenny Dorham and Woody Shaw, how much
Oh,
Woody
the
Shaw,
David Weiss interview, yeah.
and just the connection, the way that Kenny Dorham was almost this missing link between, like, the way that Kenny Dorham is using substitutions and that being kind of a key into Woody Shaw's kind of modal language. That was kind of a galaxy brain moment for me, I think. I was like, oh, I didn't see this connection. You're really making this very apparent.
I remember interviewing David years ago, and it's amazing when you can. I almost feel like when you have the chance to talk to jazz musicians about what's going on today and even in the past, it's one of the best kept secrets in writing and journalism. And I don't know if you felt like that, but when you walk away from covering this idiom, you really understand the beginnings of how this country like nurtured this art form. But there was so much ugliness that they had to overcome. I mean, the fact that Kenny and Miles and all these guys made it to where they were and they became who they were with all of the racism and all of the absolute bending of the realities that most people didn't have to deal with is in itself astonishing, you know?
It
I mean, I don't,
really is.
yeah. So I don't know how you felt about the entirety of like being able to dive into this jazz world to get all this backdrop and getting the stories and then realizing how much they had to overcome. What was kind of your general feeling about, kind of his journey and how he, I mean, the fact that we're talking about him now in 2026 as a central figure, that's a big deal.
And you just think, he did all this despite all the strictures, and I thought about one of the things that was fascinating to me is learning more about his family and particularly his parents. And I think, his dad seemed like this real salt of the earth person who just worked really hard. He was very religious, and according to Kenny himself, and really just kind of whatever the circumstances where he would find work, he would help people. He worked on construction. He worked in a naval supply depot, and so his response, I'm just going to work as hard as I can, deal with all the things that are sort of set up against me. And then, Kenny was doing the same thing, but he also went into this world that's so different, where people can really try to crush you when you stick your neck out and seek to be recognized, in a world where the power structures are so so apparent. And we even thought about that with the John wrote a lot about the critical establishment, a lot of the white critics who kind of dismissed him. And that was something he had to deal with because he was an artist. He wasn't just, a person trying to make a living. He was also trying to create this body of work that would last forever. And he had to deal with that.
No, and definitely the thing you're saying is resonant, I think, with book, just in terms of, I mean, it's someone who has this, we've talked a lot about in other interviews. I mean, someone who has this incredible level of not just instrumental ability, but also compositional ability, of such an incredible arranger, just such a deep understanding of music, and played multiple instruments, could sing. He's just unbelievable musical talent, and now it would be someone who'd probably be supported by, sort of the grant infrastructure and things like that, institutional approval, and just didn't have any of that, and was being forced to work in the sort of club environment, which financially, it's not super rewarding, not the same, but deserving more. I think that was kind of the, I don't think we ever come out and say it in the book, but it is this thing where it's like, well, this deserved more attention, it deserved more money,
And it goes
support.
all the way back to the ancestors, because so his family, apparently, from what we can tell, his mother's side of the family came enslaved to Texas, and then emancipation happened, and they acquired all this land, and the land was little by little kind of whittled away, whittled down, taken away from them. And so now you go down to Freestone County and you see these smaller ranches, but there's still places that could be leased to the oil and gas companies, and so all that like legacy wealth was never available to his family because of the very structures that you're talking about.
And I think it's interesting how things go viral. Now, at that time, there wasn't the word wasn't around, but it's that notion, like, who gets to be known and who's not known. And I think about, especially with trumpet players, like Miles was such a polarizing figure. I mean, he was as revered for what he did that was good as much as what he did bad. Like coming on stage with one note. I mean, getting beat by the cops outside of Birdland. I mean, those things. And then, Brown left us early. There's all these things that went into it. But when you get a guy like Kenny that just kind of was the guy that was the fabric. He was a nice guy. He did things for the right way. Sometimes it's like that Tom Hanks Oscar speech. The good guy finish last. And I feel like that's the beauty of these biographies that you're putting out here and that others are, is that we're finally giving some needed light on people that just did it right and they deserve to be in the pantheon of immortality in jazz.
Sure.
Definitely. Well, but that's something we talked so much about with, just this demeanor that I think we both really admired, of like, I think he had this ideology of like, the work should, I think he was not thinking about his media image.
Right.
Talking about the going viral thing, I think he was not concerned with how he, obviously he was very well dressed and stuff, but I don't think he was thinking about, how do I position myself in a certain way? How to get people to look at me in a certain way? And I love Miles, but I think that was definitely, I think by his own admission, that was a skill
Oh,
that he
yeah.
had. But for me, I really admire the, I hope our own work has some element of this, where it's like, I think for him, it's like the work, the compositions, the albums, the club dates really should speak for themselves. And it's just a model that, doesn't always, to the Tom Hanks thing, doesn't always get rewarded.
Certainly not.
And I think he knew, there are certain things, certain points when I've read some interviews with him. There's an interview that I think
Lewis
it
Porter.
was. Yeah, the Lewis Porter unearthed these interviews, and one of them was from later in his life, and the interviewer, I think it was from a radio station out on the in the Bay Area, said, "Oh, did you think like playing with Max Roach, was that like the high point of your life?" And he got a little testy. You could even hear it in his voice. He said, "No, that's what I did regularly. That kind of playing is what I was doing all along." So it was almost like he was a little bit frustrated that people thought, "Oh, you must have been so lucky to get that spot." And he was saying, "No, I was good enough, and I was playing this way, just as well and just as innovatively all through my career." So that was very interesting to me.
Yeah, I'm always very careful when I interview musicians about other musicians, like with Miles. I try to like not make that the spotlight, because it is a little demoralizing when you've had your own ride, and then all
Yeah.
people want to do is talk to you about, oh, what was Miles like, or what was so, it's like they had this lineage that superseded these little things that we all get hung up on. And we do in this idiom. Like, even right now, when I tell people I do jazz radio, they're like, oh, well, what do you play? And it's like, I create a bridge from what's happening now to then. And there's so much good thing, so many good players that are out there right now. Like the fact that the utterance of jazz is dead was even put out into the world is such malarkey. And even Sonny Rollins wrote about that, I think, in 2015 or 16 in New Yorker. He wrote about, did you remember that? And he was just talking about how, what a horrible thing to put out into the world, because it is such a living art form. And it's just like with Kenny, like Kenny still is going to have an influence on legions of kids that are playing in middle school right now, you
No,
know?
definitely.
And then your book is going to compound that, because they're going to want to know more. And now the world finally has a book on Kenny Dorham, right? So being in this unique position of father and son, what did you learn about each other in this creative process? And I'm sure you can attest to the fact that writing a book is a grueling process, from the start to the assemblage of it, to putting it actually on paper, to promoting it. It's a long, long marathon. So what did you learn about each other that you didn't realize before, that you admired about how you guys operate as human beings?
I mean, the first thing I would say, people asked us throughout the process, what it was like in kind of this, I don't know exactly how to describe it. They'd be like, oh, like, how is that? Like, I hope that's okay, kind of thing. And both of us were very much, or I mean, I can speak for myself, but
For sure.
it was definitely a positive. We didn't, I think people thought it might be more difficult to be father and son and working on something together, but it actually was. It was definitely, the process was. It's great. I think in terms of how the work actually looked, what was surprising about it was just doing it together meant, it's like sending chapters back and forth and then piecing different things together, and then science touching base about like, oh, like I'll speak with this person or you'll speak with that person. And it's just a different process than kind of going it alone. And then I also think the voice, something that people said to us that was, we were both happy to hear, was that they couldn't tell when they were reading different sections, for the most part, who had written what. And I feel like we kind of found a voice that was somewhere between the way both of us maybe would naturally write. Even if I feel like, like my dad definitely knows more about nature than I do. So if like some of the passages about Texas that have these really beautiful descriptions of the setting, it's definitely not me. But then maybe in contrast, something that's kind of, the nitty-gritty of like, the New York club ecosystem or something, that was maybe a little bit more me. But that was the biggest thing, was I think finding a voice that was hard to, where you couldn't differentiate, it didn't feel like just two chunks alternating back and forth between two of us.
I counted up. So I'm a political scientist. That's mostly what I write about. My other books have been about, but I think I've had seven co-authors, and they're all wonderful, and great people. And it was great to work with them. But John is my favorite co-author, I have to say. It was a really nice process. And I guess the thing for me is that sometimes we'd be looking at the same piece of material, and he would write about it, and I'd think, how did you get that? How did you get that out of what I was looking at? You saw something that I didn't see. So that was really cool. And then I think, we play his music, and there's kind of a similarity between, playing jazz together and writing together, because you're trying to listen to what the other person is doing, and you want to come in at the right spot. You can help. I would say you help me more than I help you, but like, I'll hear the chords, will be really solid if I'm trying to play a solo. So that was another thing I thought about. The writing and playing is similar in a way.
So let's say, in the world of writing, there's so many books that get put out on the planet every day. And there's not as many in the jazz lexicon, but there's still a lot of exposés that are out there. So I'm going to ask you to give me the elevator pitch for someone that really wants to dive in and get a new story in their arsenal of jazz history. Why should they pick up Whistle Stop? What is it about this book that you want to say for people to go out and either download or buy this book?
Do you want me to go
Yes.
I would say that it's not your typical two-part pitch. I would say it's not your typical jazz biography. It's not just, these books are great too, but it's not just your sort of like Wikipedia article with book length kind of thing. I think it's really taking in the totality of his story and all the different things that went, that blend, all the different things that went into his life and his music and sort of the crucible of influences that he came up in and the pressures that were on him, and that it's I think it's a musically detailed story, but I also think it's a personal story. I think it's a political story. And the last thing I'd say is that I think it's a very cinematic story. It's not just sort of meteoric rise to fame, and it's also not just sort of like succumbing to adversity kind of thing. It's someone who was able to do great art, didn't quite maybe get the recognition that he deserved, and still kept kind of working through that. So great, a great story, in addition to all of those other things, I would say.
Yeah, I guess picking up on the last part, it does have a sweep to it. We did not want to write a book that just said, he made this album and then he played with this person and then he died. We wanted there to, he came from people, who struggled. He came from this really vivid place that was in every part of his music. So there is definitely a sweep to the story that goes all the way back to the Civil War, up to now, because the last part of the book, we talk to people, young people now who are learning to play jazz and who revere him. So I think that's, I pick up on the last thing that John said. And the other is we really tried to look at what he was saying about his life and try to expand on it. Go to the places, listen to the music. Go to the place where he was a cowboy, herding cattle, and try to say more because he ran out of time to say more. But going by what he suggested.
Yeah, I could definitely see this as a screenplay. That was one thing that screamed out to me in that cinematic notion. So, University Press of Mississippi published the book. You can obviously go to their site, but Amazon, anywhere else where booksellers are at. So, I will make sure to get those links in the show notes. Thank you so much for taking a minute out. Thank you for putting this book out in the world. I love covering these. It's so essential to keeping this. I mean, I think it's a backdrop to the elders that talk to the younger cats. I think keeping the story really lit and bright is very essential for all of us. So thank you for taking a minute out today. I appreciate it, and best of luck with the release. And I would love to see this as a movie. So I'll look forward to the next chapter for sure.
It was a
Yeah,
great,
thank
great
you.
conversation. Thank you.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players and minds in New Jersey, Kansas City, and spots all over the world, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to both Robert and John for swinging on by the program. If you want to hear more Neon Jazz interviews, you can find us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Subscribe to us at YouTube. And for everything Neon Jazz, go to the neonjazz.blogspot.com. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Neon Jazz.
Hey there, I'm Kendra Adachi, and my show, The Lazy Genius Podcast, helps you be a genius about the things that matter and lazy about the things that don't, and you get to decide what matters. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to give you a new way to see. Episodes of the Lazy Genius Podcast are full of compassionate time management tips and permission slips to do what makes sense for you. New episodes drop every Monday. Follow and listen to the Lazy Genius Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.